Okay, so the idea at this board meeting and this year in general, we tend to spend a lot of time on the immediate things before us, like passing this budget, the coming year, and the rest. And it was our hope this year to engage at each board meeting in a larger kinds of discussions about the overall direction. And it's particularly important at this point in history because the basic structure of media, and in particularly the civic sector of media, is changing radically. And it's gonna impose some changes, whether we embrace them or not, on the way we do production, the way we do distribution, and the way we raise money. And we have to make some, I think, philosophical decisions before we can really make some strategic decisions on that point. So this is a discussion about that, and hopefully it will involve all the board, all the staff that is here, and there'll be time for listener comment as well. We have an hour and a half to do this, and when the board decided to agree to do this, it was suggested that I would do a brief presentation to sort of orient the discussion. And I wanted to start off with something that may be familiar to people. This is a program called Democracy Now, which Pacifica actually funded and still funds, created. And if you notice right up here at the top, it says Friday, September 29th, listen, watch, entire show. Click here today to buy today's show at our online store. That is the basic summary of an important component of their economic and distribution model, which is you can download their content for free any day and every day. You can put it on your podcast device. You can send it to friends. Or if you want, you can buy a CD copy of it. I tried very hard to get a response from Dennis Moynihan. Dennis, if you're out there, God, he's not listening. But about exactly what their revenue was on CDs, and I wasn't able to get an answer in time because they're doing this huge tour. And that's another component of their model, which is they're not really making their money from the sale of the content they put out every day. They're making their money and the money for all the stations, and they're responsible for a quarter of Pacifica's income, or revenue, rather. They make their money by doing things like going out into the community and doing events, which draw huge numbers because their distribution is so much larger because they don't restrict access at the front end, and actually they allow other people to promote and distribute their content. The other thing I want to say about this is the content here, you see down at the bottom, it says visit today's show page on archive.org. Archive.org is a partner, essentially, in their efforts. It is the Internet Archive, and the Internet Archive is hosting all of that content, providing server space for all of it, providing bandwidth for all the downloads of it. So it does not cost Democracy Now! Anything in their IT budget to host or distribute this stuff. So they've made a strategic decision that they're going to focus on the production of their programming and let another organization that has similar values take on huge amounts of infrastructural of the infrastructural burden. Now, that's not a general thing. They also have their own internal webmasters. They do their own internal web work, but they've made strategic decisions about what portions they're going to farm out and what portions they're going to keep in. And I hope Pete Caracas in particular can comment on this. This is an email I get every week from the National Radio Project, and I want to point out a few things here. One, at the bottom there are a number of links, which are not all on the page, about the political and substantive content of this program. But what they have on every one of these emails is listen live, a 29-minute streaming MP3. So you click on that in your email, and you can listen to the stream. You can download a 128 kbps version of this, which is essentially the CD quality, just by clicking in your email. You can download 64K MP3, which is a faster download of FM quality. You can download a one-minute promo if you just want to hear it. You can order a CD or tape, you can pay for it, and you can click for online listening help. You can also donate to their organization, and they have all the other links to everything else they're doing as part of their nonprofit organization. They have a staff of about 10, and I looked them up on GuideStar, which is the nonprofit site that has the 990s. They have a staff of about 10, a budget of about $500,000. The point I want to make about this is, making contact listeners can redistribute making contact and increase its audience simply by forwarding that email. And they've, again, made a decision. They have an economic model. We are going to distribute it. We're going to let you download this in any format that you want. We're going to offer you to sell you a hard copy of this. We're going to give you the opportunity to donate. But our goal is to get our listeners to be responsible for redistribution and expanding our audience. So they're clear about that. We, however, don't have, as an institution yet, a comprehensive policy or philosophy regarding online digital distribution and licensing and distribution rights. At each station, it's done a little different, and there are ambivalences. And I hope people can talk about those and not feel that, you know, this presentation is basically foreclosing any other legitimate take on this issue, because I'm not arguing that that ambivalence is not well-founded. We need to address it extensively, figure out why, what's there, and what might be the best way to test the new approach. Anyhow, this ambivalence and this lack of policy is one reason why this institution has been slow to move into this area, or why it has been, it's one thing that has slowed the rate at which Pacific has moved into it. I don't want to make a judgment of whether we're slow or fast relative to anyone else, but I know for a fact, based on discussions at KPFK, that one of the reasons that has retarded the rate at which we've moved into this is a lack of clarity and certainty on these points. So the question that I hope we'll be discussing is, what is our economic model going to be? To what extent are we going to rely on voluntary listener support after distribution? To what extent are we going to use subscription services or charging for access to content, either basic access or privileged access? So in a sense, basic access in what Making Content's doing is downloading it, and privileged access is paying for a CD. So we need to look at that. If we're confronted with situations where a fee is going to restrict how broadly something is distributed, how will we decide whether to go the free route or the voluntary contribution route? I think we should have overarching policy on this question after a discussion about it, so that we don't re-bring it up with that as subtext to every concrete decision. Do we want to adopt a general policy calling for strategies that promote the largest possible distribution and listenership, i.e., should the default in our digital distribution strategies be open access? And I should have said, or not. Under what circumstances, if any, might we prefer another approach? And I just want to end with the fact that the upper one is a podcast kit available for $249 down below. I don't know the price on this one, but if you do a search for podcast kit in Google, you'll find a profusion of resources. You'll find how-tos. You'll find equipment. You can start with a simple kit from $99 all the way up to $1,000 if you want to do it. The point is that our stations are not necessarily going to be the main place where civically driven broadcasters are doing their production in the future. And people will be able to roll their own. They'll be able to produce it on their own. They'll be able to distribute it on their own, which leads to the question of, in the past, Pacifica stations have functioned essentially as local monopolies. That was the way that a listener got access to civic-driven audio content. And you had to be at that station to get access to the audience. So in a way, what the stations functioned as, what management had to do, was balance competition for that monopoly access. But now the ability to produce and distribute is basically within reach of almost anyone, certainly of any organization. And the question is, how are we going to respond to a world in which we're not a monopolist anymore? And very often people keep behaving in the same ways they've always behaved when the situation has become radically different. And in a sense, they recreate the same dynamics even when the situations have changed and it has a big impact on survival. So the question I hope we can address ourselves to here is, how is Pacifica going to balance and respond to the twin forces of competition, i.e. there's a lot of other civic broadcasters out there, and collaboration, i.e. we could be providing services to them and getting them to come distribute on Pacifica platforms, depending on how we do it. So how are we going to balance those things in the civic media world of the future? So that was my quick take on setting the tone, and now I'd like to throw it open. I want to start with the ED, and then I'm sure some people have some clear thoughts, and I was definitely hoping to go to Pete and Brian to start off with, and then we'll throw it more open more broadly. We have an hour and a half total. I'd like to spend maybe an 45 minutes in discussion and then get some public comment and then come back and have a little more discussion on this. So, Greg, please go ahead.
Yeah. No, I don't want to speak that long, but in preparation for this, I did sort of pose a number of questions to some of the people on the staff, and I'm hoping they've been thinking about them, about basically what
Mike.
Are their, you know, excuse me?
More Mike.
More Mike?
Yeah.
More Mike, okay. Basically, a discussion with them about what they think the current model is that we're working with, what concerns they have about the impact that moving toward an alternative might pose for the current revenue, for the questions of rights, are we in a way cutting off, or is there a fear that we may be, by giving it away or seeming to give it away, cutting off our potential for the revenue streams that we've come to depend on? But I think underneath all of this, one of the main differences between the situation that Pacific is in and the models that Dave threw up is that Democracy Now! And most of these others are particular shows where the issue of who owns the content is not really in doubt. Democracy Now! Owns their content, and they can decide how and how widely to distribute and to whom and who to allow to have access. But we operate in a very different environment. We have perhaps 1,000 people who contribute content, primarily volunteer people, and they believe, and I think we all agree to some extent, they have rights to their content. Now, what rights, and whether these are exclusive rights, and what rights we, the organization, may or may not have as well, is one of the main unanswered questions that we're going to have to resolve, and in a way we've been hesitant to resolve. Brian, I think, posed a number of questions to John Kriegler, and I'm hoping he can sort of discuss that. I just want to underline one of them, because you shared some of that with me, and I also asked Dan Siegel similar kinds of questions about the question of who owns our content now. And you're asking two lawyers, you usually get very different responses, but actually we got very similar responses. Basically, what both of them said is that if you were an employee, well, it belongs to your employer. That's Pacifica's content. But on the other hand, if you're a volunteer, particularly if you're a volunteer who's not even using your facilities, which is increasingly the case at Pacifica, and was really reinforced to me quite strongly when I was visiting station recently, people are not even using the station. They're producing their content, and then we are transmitting it. But they are creating that value themselves. And we are simply one of a number of possible distribution mechanisms that they have available to them. Well, who owns that? The argument can be made and is made that it belongs to them. Our argument is, to some extent, is that, well, perhaps it should be shared. But it's a gray area. And that's what Dan Siegel said. And he said, basically, our corporate counsel said that we really need to create a policy that protects us and establishes what the relationship is between volunteer programmers and the institution. The same question asked to John Kriegler is in relationship who is the author of the work. You can answer it in a lot of different ways, but if you leave it to a court, they're going to establish who actually contributed to the creation of this value. We have not yet resolved that. What he said was, this is going to bedevil us until we actually address it in writing. And there are a number of ways that we could. We could make all our volunteer producers, in a sense, some sort of staff for hire, or make them joint authors of all the material, or offer them the option to be joint authors. Or we could ask them to license it to us for specific uses or specific periods of time. But we have to do something to resolve the uncertainty that exists right now, because right now we don't really know who owns most of the material that we are now distributing. And that creates a problem not only for these kinds of distribution strategies, but for our reuse of them when we want to create premiums. It's very unclear, and it's one of the key questions that's preventing us from resolving this. I'll just leave that and just throw it open to on the other side of the room.
Before you do that, I want to point out two things. One, it is quite clear that in the programming that Pacifica produces by paid producers,
yes,
Pacifica owns that. And I'm hoping we don't get, I mean, while that question's important, the larger question is, if we could have it any way we wanted it, what would we want? It's certainly the case that we pay for a certain amount of programming, Informativo, Pacifica, and some other things as well at each local station, that we definitely have the rights to do what we want with. As far as volunteer-produced content, volunteers who produce the content, that's their content. They're the authors of it. But they give us distribution rights. That's why we're able to air it. The question is, what distribution rights might we want to ask them for? But that is contingent on what our philosophy is about how we distribute. And I feel like if we get caught in the who owns what tussle, we'll miss the discussion about what do we want our social and economic role to be. So that's my personal opinion, and I will stop intruding. Pete?
Before getting into specifics on rights and distributions, I wanted to give some background in terms of technology and basic economics. I think it would really help this discussion. If one was to look at spending in IT in this country alone and globally and chart it, going back 15, 20 years.
Pete, if you take the windscreen off, your volume will be a lot better.
Okay. What you'll see is a tremendous jump in...
And point the mic away from the speaker behind you.
What you'll see is a tremendous jump, billions of dollars being invested in research and development, in technology. What I'm trying to say is this explosion of technology that we see, especially in the last 10 years, is not a magical fluke. It's not something that maybe it's just a phase. Literally, private investment, public investment, federal investment in the billions has gone into where we are today. What happened, fortunately, for institutions like us, which were a little behind the times, we had a little lag for a few years. If you were to look at the last 10 years, from 97 to 2000, the R&D money invested, and the private capital particularly, after the internet bubble burst, these are very real factors in why we are here today. When the internet bubble burst and the public billions that went into this new technology was gone, and the Y2K bug came, we had the biggest of the smallest organizations investing 3 or 4 years forward technical funds and R&D funds in 97, 98, 99 to preempt the Y2K bug. So what happened was in 2000, 2001, 2002, the monies was not there for new technology, new research investment. It had been spent for this bogus Y2K bug. This is the fact. Now, when you go in, if you go to a voice over IP conference, or if you go to a podcast conference and people discuss the big picture, where we are today, why did VoIP come out a few years ago? Why is this new technology coming out now? We are seeing another quantum leap starting in 03, 04, when the Y2K bug and that monies that was spent years earlier had caught up and people were now able to reinvest in technology, in research and development. You started to see this new influx of technology. Okay, what I'm trying to say here is we're in the beginning phase of another quantum leap in technology. In the next 5 to 6 years, there will be an exponential growth again in this money, unless we have a major stock crash, unless we have some other international or national issues, which is possible. But barring those, we have lost the opportunity. We had a few years there to catch up post Y2K, and we did not. We focused, even during our record revenues years, on everything but technology. And I'm going to say, the reason we're having this discussion on, beyond the legal issues and whatnot, in pure technical terms, okay, we are in a much worse situation than you folks even realize. Because we are more behind the curve if you project forward than you realize. FY05, FY06, FY07, very little investment in this area. Forget about the hardware and the technology. David made an issue about talking about making contact with Democracy Now. These are small staff, smaller institutions, and the 10 people at Making Contact and the couple of dozen at Democracy Now do not have the technical lag that we have. Our paid and unpaid staff are vastly behind these other organizations. Even investment in hardware. You'll get me a $2,500 server tomorrow, and I'll deal with the archive, for example, for the audio port. That's meaningless in the big picture of this organization, because the local stations don't have the human resources, with the exception of maybe one station, to bring up the whole to where we need to be. I don't want to be an alarmist, but I'm just trying to give you folks a big picture of what is going on into technology, and we have to stop dragging our feet, okay? Because that's what this organization... We have not been serious about technology from the moment I became a staff here. I've not seen, other than talk, any real effort in moving forward. Aside from what we do with this digital rights, we have to really address where we will be in 5 years, or will we be in here in 5 years? Because when this next tsunami of R&D money comes down, it's going to level and restructure the technical playing field like it did a few years ago. And we will be more in the back, more in the dust, and our numbers will be that much, you know, in proportion scaled down. Our listenership is going to go with that, et cetera, et cetera.
Pete, what is it going to take for our content to flow out, in your opinion, for our content to be able to flow out over all the new distribution platforms that are being developed, both the technological platforms and business model platforms?
The barriers are multiple barriers. The technical barrier is real, but again, the money's, I don't think, is the real significant factor. There's grant opportunities we can get for this hardware, et cetera. The real barrier here, and you folks have to take a look at this seriously, and unfortunately, I'm afraid that it won't happen, I have to say. The real barrier is a human resource barrier at the local level and at the national level, where the staff we have is undertrained, is behind the curve, and often so resistant they are unwilling. Okay, my experience, for example, at BAI with introducing new technologies was very, very eye-opening.
But you can't get large-scale funding for a development plan without the development plan. And the point of this is really to focus on what is the plan, the vision for the use of these things that we can step out and ask for funding to be able to do the training of human resources and the rest. Because with a plan about how what our role is going to be in this world, you can actually go get money. But with no plan, by going and saying, well, we don't have a plan yet, it's very hard to get them to fund that. So what are your thoughts on the proper positioning in this world that would allow us to then say, okay, here's the vision, now we need funding to fund this vision?
Well, there's a practical answer and there's a theoretical answer. In theory, I can tell you what we need to do. But again, in practice, I've spent the last 4 years creating solutions for this organization that either don't get used or are grossly underused. I can create a plan, I can execute a plan for little or no money. If it's not embraced, if it's not utilized, then is it there? You know, is it, you know? So that's the real issue. What has to happen, David, is we have to collectively, the local stations, the national office, has to iron out a plan that will be followed, executed, that will incorporate these needs, but that people will buy into and actually embrace. And that is the big problem. People do not want to buy into these things. The level of resistance, again, for I don't know whatever reason, okay, is there. And those are practical, real barriers that someone has to address. The bylaws won't fix this. My technical skills won't fix this.
Okay, well, before we go on to Brian, if you could just quickly touch on the theoretical aspect of it, because I think buy-in is contingent to some degree on getting the concept. So what do you think from a theoretical point?
3 years ago, I put together a budget. Well, you know, 3 years ago and now is a big change in technology again. The price of disk space then and the price of disk space now and bandwidth, et cetera, has changed. It's like when you were looking for real estate in a space where it's $10 a square foot, and then it jumps to $50 a square foot to $5 a square foot. That's what happened. In other words, there's been a big change in the pricing models because of all this new influx of monies. We can get more servers, more bandwidth, more disk space than I projected 3 years ago for 10% of the money that I put in the budget three years ago. Now, you know what? I can put together a schematic of what you need, hardware, etc. And I mean, if that's what you're looking for, I would suggest that's we're jumping the gun here.
Well, the question was really about the distribution strategy to be part of whatever distribution platforms develop. I am making the assumption that Pacifica in and of itself cannot distribute develop every platform that it may want to have its content flow out on. And by its content, I mean the content of anybody who's wants to share in that distribution. I think we should move to Brian. Maybe you think about that when we come back. Brian?
Yeah, hi.
You've got a ton of content. But you got a ton of content, but don't know if we can use it.
Yeah, I was glad that Greg spoke up about the legal counsel, because I was hesitant in bringing information from an attorney for you, because it's illegal for me to give legal advice, and I didn't know where the line was drawn, and I really didn't understand the construct of this discussion until pretty much after I saw some things on the board. So let me basically say that the mission statement of the Pacifica Radio Archives is to collect, preserve, describe, and make available for research use the content and broadcast history of Pacifica Radio, which means that accessibility, as wide as possible, is in our mission statement. So philosophically, we agree with distributing the material of Pacifica to as many people as possible based on the technology that is in hand at the time. It's really great to hear from Pete that technology is going to leap us forward again, and unfortunately we are behind the times. I think what concerns the archive and the archiving world, the dimension of archiving, is the aspect of archiving. In distributing things digitally, how is it being archived? How does archiving and preservation beyond our own lifetimes be integrated into a medium and a technology that we don't know what the future is? We do know what the future is of analog reel-to-reel tape, 75 years or so. One of our concerns is the state of... now let's talk about the archive material that's finite in reel-to-reel tape. We're concerned about the state of fair use in public domain. What we mean by concern is that there have been laws recently as 2002 that released some dated material into public domain and fair use, which means there's a lot of material pre-1978 in the archives that is now freed up for us to distribute freely as we choose. And that's actually good news, I hope, for those that are in favor of this model. We were concerned about the programs in the archive that have music embedded that have uncertain and complex issues for artist, composer, and record label. So when we look at new programs that use music within the program that we sort of don't know about, who reviews that program to make sure that everything's in order before you put it on the internet and throw it out there? So at the programming level, the producer level, or some level of station oversight, there has to be some restrictions on what goes into the program that you intend to throw out into the ether. That's not a bad word to use, is it, when I'm used to talk about the internet?
Throw out.
And we have a concern about, will Pacifica standardize contracts and releases to enable fair distribution? What legal counsel and what Greg has passed on to you is that the standards aren't there. There are no policies that allow a fair review of the programming to enable fair use of that material. So I look forward to further meetings at the working level to answer some of those questions for distribution in the future, but also to look at and review the archives materials. We have some magic wands that we can wave and talk about some of this fair use public domain release material. And we have a few wands about what we know is Pacifica owned based on the information we have. Karen Coyle, who wrote the database, Pacifica Radio Archives database review through the grant, I think it was in the last board meeting. It was a very lengthy program. In addition to her consulting with the archives on our database, she is one of the leaders in the Society of American Archivists and the archiving dimension that is working on database information of how do you describe material that you don't know the rights to? What are the factors in the fields that will give you one more field of information to get you to the use of fair use? So to enable, to include her in the workload of describing and putting together a database that allows not only more information about the archive material, but future information for future people about the current material, I think would be incredibly valuable to the discussion. Well, I think that's all.
Let me ask one more question. You've done a pilot project distributing from the vault, advertising it for sale for CDs. How would a model like Democracy Now's, where they are offering the stuff for how would you feel about the offer for download model with a pitch on it intermittently? How might that affect CD sales? And how might a sales approach affect distribution and the number? I mean, what are your thoughts about which one of those routes is going to work both in mission terms and in revenue terms?
Let me start with a couple examples, and then let me see if I can figure out what the root of the question is. Democracy Now!, when Democracy Now! Was owned by Pacifica and when the Pacifica Audio Archives was the unit to archive it on digital reel-to-reel masters and make it available for tape sales, in a single year, the last year we had sales of Democracy Now!, it was $90,000. $90,000 in a year. I don't know if that amount, I don't think you'll ever get the figures from Democracy Now! On what those tape CD sales are when they went into the digital distribution, so I don't know that we'll ever get that answer. Philosophically, with From the Vault, I would love to let it be downloaded and distributed. Right now it is streamed and podcast on our new audio site that was built with the help of Pete Karakas, John Sirius, Mark Torres, and Sean Dulles. However, right now, I still don't have all the questions, all the answers I have about that fair use copyright within the programs we use. So, for instance, a program on Margaret Mead, when we used 10 different programs, we didn't really know what the use was. So I went to Margaret Mead Centennial Celebration, contacted Margaret Mead's daughter. So our deal into getting permission for use of the material is we preserve, digitize the recordings of Dr. Margaret Mead. We donate those recordings to Dr. Mead's daughter and to their institution, and in return we get the permission to use the program in the program. But what we haven't gotten to the point is, will you allow us to distribute it for free for download for other people to use? Right. That question is not answered.
Okay. John, can you weigh in on this?
I'm very excited about this.
Mike. You're the engineer. Come on, man.
Okay, I'm not on mic. I'm not used to speaking on mic. I'm very excited about this whole program. I think we have to understand that it's not an all-or-none type situation, as Brian kind of said. I think that when we're talking about setting up with producers to find out how much we own, how much they own, that's not an all or none either. I don't think we should have a menu of things, and they make an agreement with us, you know? And then we can move forward. We decide how we distribute it on the grounds of how much they want and how much we want.
On the question of, you know, there's a balance between broad distribution and your revenue model. In other words, if you ask somebody to pay for a subscription service, you'll get the revenue up front but less distribution. If you ask for it after you've distributed it, you'll get wider distribution, and the question is, does the revenue match? And then the last question is, how much money are you spending for that distribution? Can you afford in the digital realm to do what you do on the FM, which is give it away? Because in the FM world, a marginal listener, one additional listener, doesn't cost you anything else. So there comes a question of whether you're paying the cost of those additional listeners or whether you're partnered with other organizations who are paying that cost. And that's a design decision, not some, you know, decision of nature. Pete wants to talk to that, and Nathan.
I'm going to make you a little more concrete to the last question you asked me that I was unable to answer earlier. My experience with BAI is one I'll use to make it concrete here. The distribution model that I would embrace myself, that I've argued for since I've been staff here, is one that reflects our model on the air. It's like you articulated, David. We put it out there, and the more people embrace that distribution, a small percentage, just like over the air, will pay for that. Now it's on to us to create the structure for that to happen. And that's where we have failed. And let me be specific. Okay, at WBAI, I set up a podcast archive system. If you look at, it's been up for about 18 months. It started just a few months after the podcast craze began. We launched this thing. Okay, well, the modifications that have not happened in the last year and a half that are holding back the revenue there, the traffic has exploded. Some of our programmers, you know, the overnight programmers, for example, who had very little audience 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, are some of the more successful programs. Okay, because now the level playing field is there, and people are downloading these 3 a.m. programs, whereas they couldn't stay up at 3 a.m. to get those shows. And some of these are very successful. There's no reason those people won't pay for that show, just like they do over the airwaves. This has been our history. The reason why we are paying this bill here is because of this model. It's not reinventing the wheel here. The modifications that have to happen are simple. For example, we need to promote it. We need to promote it on the air and other mediums where we do it, and on the actual file itself. The MP3s that are distributed for download and replay have a pitch at the beginning and a pitch at the end. At BAI, that pitch has never been modified. It doesn't even say the website. It doesn't say a number you can call. It's the same one voice, where the system is built so that every producer can have a custom pitch with his or her sound. They don't do that at WBAI. They have this one generic without even a call to action pitch. That's not a pitch. That's not even, it's a soft pitch. So that's one modification. Two, a third one is the email counterpart that David showed, the National Public Radio.
That's National Radio Project.
I'm sorry, the National Radio Project. If we learn how to leverage that, MoveOn is a great example too. How they use their membership list and their emails for specific requests, targeting specific people. So I'm ready to start an alpha test on the newpacifica.org. The newpacifica.org is going to be coming out shortly. It's not quite ready for beta test for the public, but the alpha test, meaning that I'm going to be working with producers when I go back to Brooklyn to start using this. Part of the new site will let the end user, the public, subscribe, not for a fee, just sign up with their email so they can then get, they can bookmark their favorite show. They'll be able to find, it's a Pan-Pacifica guide where you can find, let's say, labor from WBAI, KPFA, KPFT, tech programs, et cetera, et cetera. You can sort and find your shows. You're not limited to your one station anymore. So there's going to be a lot of new features in there. And how will we leverage that and this list that this will generate together with our archives and these pitches, et cetera? This will determine how successful this will be. On top of that, you need the right premiums. You're not going to distribute podcast, internet replay, or download to people and expect them to fork over $150 for a video. That's too high of a barrier. These are folks all over the world. They're not in your listening area. We need to create premiums that will target them, that will lower the barrier, like $2 or $3 a month, for example.
Okay. Yeah, I just want to say the one of the things that I've heard as a source of ambivalence about letting people download the content is, well, then we can't use it for premium, the content for premiums, if people can download it. Could you address that?
Sure. What is downloadable, what is available, is purely in our control. The system is such that we can make the proper modifications. Come pledge time, we can take away the right to download
our podcast. The question is whether we would want to do that.
Well, I would argue that we would want to restrict the download available of some of these premiums, but that we can try that model out and then modify it again. Well, I would make it available for replay, and I wouldn't make it available the premiums for download, and I think that's fine. And if someone really wants to download it, having a play link is sufficient for them to download. We're not really trying to you know.
Yeah.
So
Nathan, and then Lonnie, and then Bob, and then actually we'll come straight down the line.
I'm sorry,
Nathan.
Just, I mean,
Yeah, go ahead.
I don't know if I'm expressing myself clearly enough for the board to understand, but this is an illustration. This is my experience at BAI illustrates to me how we've tried to embrace this technology, but without full buy-in and full participation of the local level, it's going to be ineffective. Okay.
Well, I think that BAI directors are interested in being able to deal with some of this, if I'm right. So let's come down the line and get to them, Nathan, and we will definitely come back. Go ahead, Nate.
I'm very excited about all this discussion. There is a lot of possibility here. We also, in terms of the ownership of what ownership and distribution rights and remuneration rights and all those things, happen to be looking at that at my station, WORT, and as far as that goes, the big issue I think with the ownership is if we decide we don't own the material that's produced at our stations by unpaid staff, we really don't have anything to discuss. I mean, if the producer owns it, we have no.
That's not true. You can require assigning or the right to distribute, which we have implicitly when we air it. They're giving us the right to distribute it there. That is implicit. We can make explicit. And it, depending on what our model is, when you ask them to assign a right to you, mm-hmm. you have to know what you're going to do with it. If you don't know that, you can never write that license. And so we stay frozen where we've been.
Okay. Fair enough. I guess it just depends on whatever contract we come up with. Good call. But the more interesting things to me are the distribution questions and the philosophy of distribution. And I'm very much in favor of a free distribution of this stuff rather than pay up front to subscribe.
Why?
I've got several reasons. at the very least, we could do a play where you hit play and it streams it. I'm also, though, not against actual MP3 downloads, so you've got it on your local machine as well. There's at least three reasons. I could probably think of more later, but... First, just sort of as an interesting point, I mean, a lot of folks that I've heard on this board have been talking about an aging listenership, wanting to bring in more youth listeners and young listeners and things like that. Folks my age and younger and even older are listening to stuff online. That's where it's going. And that's just how it's going to keep going, I think. I mean, every study, every trend points that direction. So to tap into that, I think this is crucial to get into this business. The other part of that that's sort of a corollary is that the standard for listening to stuff online is that it's free. I don't even bother with stuff that's not free. If you have to pay up front, to hell with it. I'll go somewhere else. Second reason for free download stuff. Second reason for download for free. Maximizing listenership, I think, is what we're really after, both as far as our mission goes. And early on, we need to think of digital and online distribution as a service. I don't think it's going to be profitable at the beginning, honestly. It may, but I don't know if it will. We're going to build a listenership first and build sort of the idea that you download the stuff, you listen to it, you love it, and you sort of give us money. and then that's part of it. But I think the mission of the organization is such that we want to share news and public affairs and cultural information and entertainment, and all in sort of the name of peace and social justice. And so that's really what we're kind of trying to do and why we're trying to maximize listenership. And then the third reason, which kind of comes out of the second, is that in the spirit of community radio and Lou Hill's old philosophy of it, we broadcast stuff for free. I mean, you don't have to pay us any money to tune in to any of our stations. And a lot of people don't, even though they listen. So it's got to be kind of one of these things that we send it out there for free, and we hope that people, we trust that listeners will contribute. Now, there's ways to do that, and I agree with a lot of the outreach and methods that Pete sort of suggested there, as far as putting a tag at the beginning, the end, as far as using email databases of our members, having email signups, all that kind of stuff. Is going to be very effective, I think, at doing that. On the other point that hasn't been addressed as much but was part of your PowerPoint, the possibilities for collaborations with other civic-minded producers. I think there are tremendous possibilities in that regard. If we think about programming in an open-minded kind of fashion, there's collaborating with these sort of decentralized, civically minded podcasters in our communities is going to help us connect more with those communities. We can pick the best material that fits a particular program at the station, and it'll enrich our programs. It'll bring new voices to the air. It'll increase the number of voices on the air. I think it'll just make us all stronger. So I'll go ahead and pass.
Lonnie.
Okay, just a few comments to make. I think that we have to look at what are the options that we have. And let's take the distribution options. We can have a distribution concept that says lateral distribution, which is that we take our content and we make it available widely. That's what I'm calling a lateral distribution model. We've actually been talking all around two or three different models. I'm trying to clarify that. The second one is bottom up, that we look to community members, to individuals, to freelance producers to produce content for us. And we take that content and make it available. But it's a different model. It's not taking content that we already have. It's taking content we don't already have and bring it into our distribution system and make it available. I think you just alluded to that. But remember, these are three different models, not exclusive. We cannot have, you know, exclusive models. I don't think we need all three. And then there's a top-down model, which is the model we're sort of working with now. People sit, make content, we distribute it down to the end user. I think we need all three. I don't think we could afford. There are two Pacificas. There are Pacific. The average Pacifica user is using dial-up. So are they our end product user? No, they're not. They're not. They're 52. They don't even like computers. So we have to have a clear sense of who our customers are, if you'll pardon me using that phrase. They are young people. This is our youth strategy. Young people are happy with podcasting. They're comfortable with it. They know computers. They're not using dial-up. So we have to have a clear idea of who our customer is. That has to be part of the strategy. Now, so I'm suggesting all three. I think we have to have a clear, we can be the distributor of existing content, or we can be the distributor of original content. And I'm suggesting that we ought to lean to original content, not the content that is already embroiled in rights and already embroiled and all the rest of it. It'll take months to unravel that. So we need new sources of content other than the ones we have.
What is going to make it attractive about our distribution strategy for talented producers to use our distribution
approaches?
Absolutely. What services are we going to be providing? Mm-hmm. What services do you think we need to strategize to be able to provide that's going to make other people want to use our platform?
Let's be blunt. If we spend millions on technology and think putting that in the hands of some of our current users, that won't work. But if we take new technology and put it in the hands of young people, even in the community, it will work. It's just a straightforward proposition because the learning curve is not there and the interest perhaps is not there. And we can do that. It won't take much to put certain kinds of technology in the hands of people who can produce original content for Pacifica, which we will own. So I think we have to have current content producers. We have to look at new content producers and new distribution systems for those two Pacificas, and not that we're abandoning one or the other, we're just expanding it. A couple of more things and I'm done. Collaboration. Pacifica does not have the wherewithal to change the world. We need partners in the community, technological partners. We can go out and buy all the technology we want and it will sit in the closet. I've seen it happen. So we need to identify in each of our communities, or even nationwide, it can be an international tech partner, a partner who can help us bring the technology to bear in our institution around the distribution questions and places that we want to go.
So as CFO, I just want to ask a pointed question. How do we fund? Everybody in Pacifica is all in terms of all their time. Pete talked to how the human resources are just totally up against it. How are we going to fund the development work needed to develop those partnerships? And just quickly, because we don't have a lot of time, there are people got their hands up, and so I want to hit everybody.
We go out and buy it.
Okay.
Can I just clarify something for a second? In terms of numbers, again, the BAI model, the entire cost for the 12 months of using this system that was set up at BAI was less than $2,500.
Yeah, I'm not talking about that cost. I'm talking about the human time.
Yes, but there was a reference made to millions. I don't want to give the impression that any of these models entail millions in technical investment. $2,500 for the whole year to do the BAI archive is all that it cost.
Right, but what I'm talking about is, like, Ursula has had to be the person who goes out and creates partnerships with other stations. You need people in each station whose job is to create partnerships with whatever entities you want to collaborate with, and that was really the essence of my question. I'm going to go to Lisa, and then I got... after Lisa comes Bob, Don, Alan, Pete, John, Rob, AC, and Brian, and Ray, and Phil. I don't want any time limit on this, frankly, but I will call for an extension of time when we arrive at time.
Okay.
We also want to leave. Well, we have a public comment session, so Lisa, go ahead.
I was going to say, we can put time limits after I speak, only joking. I just want to first of all say that there's been some discussion about producers' rights of paid and unpaid, and I just want to say, speaking unofficially as somebody with the programming committee, especially since we're being streamed, that there's been so much discussion about this. So people may have heard comments pertaining to what the court might recognize, but it does not necessarily mean that that's absolutely the model. I know we've been talking very, very much about, you know, coming up with policies that will be fair, you know, to both the paid and unpaid in terms of respecting their creative rights, because I wouldn't want to see a situation like what happened with Superman when they sold the rights or whatever, then it became so big, and, you know, so I just want to clarify, you know, just talk about that. We've been discussing that quite a bit and haven't come up with anything yet, but it goes to show that we need to. This is such a vast, vast topic, and it's one of those kind of things because there's so many different directions with it, and sometimes we talk and talk that we need to do it, but we leave with what we need, and we all agreed that we need to do something, but we don't necessarily really know what we need to do. And I know, Dave, you made a recommendation one time within the programming committee that we need to begin to just move it, this conversation toward, okay, let's just put something out there, a little defined in terms of saying we want to start with creating this that will take us into this point, give this example, and that way we can, you know, look into it and invest it in order to bring to move this forward into just the abstract. We're saying, okay, we want to start with at least this piece of the pie.
Can I specify what that was?
Sure.
Lawrence Lessig, who's developed the Creative Commons licenses, has a creative a hybrid license, which is part non-commercial and part commercial. And the non-commercial part is basically, you can go to creativecommons.org, which says if you're using it for civic purposes, you can do unrestricted distribution. If you're using it for commercial purposes, then there's a commercial portion that calls for revenue sharing. And what I said to the programming committee, since they were struggling over how to specify what it should do, is a better way to proceed is to get the attorney to draft something and then talk about that concrete language. And so Lessig has said that, you know, the non-commercial part is sitting there ready. What we need to do is define what we want the commercial part to be and to write that. And I think we should get that drafted, and then we can consider something concrete.
And then just a few other things. So I think that's important. I just even know, and I just want to say that, you know, as a director and a member of the LSB, I am open to anybody with WBAI or any coming to me and talking with me about anything, because that's what the purpose is for. So I don't ever want somebody to feel that they're overstating the case, and that's the only way we're going to get something moving forward. So I'll even just put out some of the suggestions that I've heard in terms of, because I know we've been hearing a lot about the technology committee, or the technology, I should say, the issue and the lack thereof, and where we've kind of let things fall through the cracks. And I want to just say to the people working the technology and stuff that I really do hear you, although I might not always show that I do. But certain things we got to just start thinking about right now, even in terms of some very basic things. We continue to hear about the human resources and lack thereof with the technology issue. I mean, we need to just put something on the table. We need assistant administrators. One of the things I've been hearing said that we need. I would like, I don't know if I can do this now as a form of motion or when, but we really need to have some conversations about hiring, at least starting with that point, assistant administrators, some real conversations about let's put it forward, hire it, and then even go further with, you know, what else we need. And I also just want to say one other thing. We have the local station boards, too, so please, especially people that work at WBAI, we want to hear those comments, too, instead of some of the things that we usually hear during public comment. So please feel free to come, too, and just talk to us. And, you know, we want to hear some of those things.
Hey, Bob?
That would be nice.
Well, this discussion is opening up so many exciting possibilities, and I agree with Lonnie that we should look at all the different options. That we should think about strategies that involve both material that we already have broadcast, and so we are connected to in some way with the, and I'll get back to the ownership rights in a minute, as well as new content that doesn't exist, current producers and new people at the community level that may not be producers of a regular scheduled radio show but may have great content and that we need to bring in using these multiple platforms and different technologies. I want to talk for a minute about the audio archive that Pete was so instrumental in setting up based on the programming that Otis McClay had done at WBAI. This has really been a great thing. It's very much well received by the producers and I think by the listeners as well. And I'm really honored to have been able to excite a donor to cover the cost of the first 5 years of maintaining this archive. And I think that shows the potential that when you have a concrete project that is very exciting for moving the station in a new direction, you can get the funding. There are people out there who really want to be part of the cutting edge of technology. But it does, one problem we've run into, which I think Pete has alluded to, is it needs personnel to support it ongoingly. Pete generously donated tens of hours of his time for about a year and a half, and finally he couldn't do that any longer and maintain his Pacifica job. And it's been a struggle to get the time from the existing overstretched staff at BAI to do that work. So that has to be part of the plan. I agree with him about the need for beefing up the pitches on these archives. That's something that there needs to be leadership from station management to get the producers enlisted in putting their personalized pitches on there, linking it more explicitly to the website, to the phone number. All that stuff is very valuable. And maybe even thinking about setting up smaller donations for people who are not quite ready to spring for the $25 to become a member but would kick in after they've heard a lot of exciting archival programs, kick in for $5 or a smaller amount. Promotion, email, regular weekly. When I was the editor of the website, I established a weekly e-newsletter for the station, began that. It didn't quite cover the time when we really launch deeply into the online archive, but I think that's something that can be developed further, and we can encourage individual show hosts to use their email newsletters or to help them set up newsletters to promote the show via the website, saying, you know, if you missed it, go to the site and you can listen to it. Maybe even providing some help for programmers who don't have websites, want to establish them. The station could be a resource to get volunteer web designers to help work with programmers to do that. Again, all in the service of getting the content distributed more broadly, and which includes the fact that the one limitation of this current archive is that it's only for 90 days for public affairs, and because of copyright issues, it's only for 14 days for music shows. So maybe we can think about strategies to keep some of the, at least the sort of the best of, on a permanent audio archive that, you know, and then that could be more sorted by subject matter and so on, which brings us to something Dave has introduced us to, which is the virtual program director software, which maybe you can talk about better than I can, that allows you to assemble your own stream, your own self-designed stream
and podcast
of the shows that you like on the schedule that works in your life. The other part about archiving that it can lead to, as we saw in the Democracy Now! Example, is CDs that you can order for a fee, which I think, you know, there's a fair number of people who still really want the CDs. For whatever reason, the podcasting is not their preferred mode. And I think there's money in there and, again, more distribution opportunities. Just a couple more things. The The other new idea that Dave's been talking about, which I'm very intrigued by, is the PodSafe radio archive, by which we could bring in, I mean, Pacifica knows a huge number of musicians that are not part, and spoken word artists and poets who are not part of the mainstream, who aren't connected to big record labels, who would love to have the kind of distribution that we, because of our national reach, we can achieve. And again, maybe Dave can explain the specifics of how that might work, but I would propose to expand that further into a concept of a Pacifica record label. I mentioned this at the June board meeting, but I'm willing to be part of a task force to start researching making this a reality. It would be something that could expose up-and-coming musicians and cultural workers to a much larger audience, and at the same time start creating a revenue stream for Pacifica that could also be shared with the musician, with the artist, based on a cooperative agreement. Which brings me to the last point about rights. And we in the unpaid staff organizing committee at WBAI have given a lot of thought and study to the question of the copyrights and the legal rights to our material that we broadcast. And we've consulted with attorneys, and we're very convinced that there's absolutely no question that this belongs to us. And there may even be questions that it's not as clear that the paid staff are absolutely devoid of any rights, but that's another discussion. The point here is that as Pacifica moves forward to forge policy, we have to have a direct dialogue with our unpaid staffs and their associations and unions and lawyers for those associations to forge language that I'm very optimistic we can forge win-win language. Definitely. That will, you know, will serve all of our purposes. We'll help give some revenue to the, you know, totally underpaid, non-unpaid staff that we spend money out of our pockets to do this work. It could give us some revenue and could definitely increase Pacifica's revenue. So let's again put together a task force and get to work on a cooperative drafting process.